I can't help but plug Friday night's poet, Night of Poetry. These poets, Bonnie and Catherine and Amber and Emily and Jim Dillon, they were absolutely amazing. We have such amazing talent in this parish, so thank you so much. I want to give a shout out to them. So my grandmother used to sing a song when I was a kid. And maybe some of you have heard it, but it goes something like this. If you can't help me, please don't stop me. Move out of my way. Don't try to block me. I got a race to run. And I'm running by faith. If you can't help me, move out of my way. One more time. Come on, sing it with me. If you can't help me, please don't stop me. Please don't stop me. Move out of my way. Move out of my way. Don't try to block me. Don't try to block me. I got a race to run. And I'm running by faith. If you can't help me, move out of my way. That song that my grandmother sang was a justice song. It was meant to send a message to those who chose not to further help injustice work, to at least commit to not being in opposition of its path by simply moving themselves or any obstacles out of the way. You know, all of us have had some obstacles of one another put in our way. Just take a minute and think about that. Think about what obstacles were put in your way. Just think about that for a minute. And now I want you to think about how your life would have been shaped differently if someone had removed them. So you see, the reason that this song was so necessary was because being a daughter of sharecroppers and enslaved people who fought for a place of belonging and thriving, she saw that the world had two options toward helping her to that end, to either be part of the solution or part of the problem. And if you were going to be part of the problem, this song simply invited you to move to the side, out of the way. These last few weeks, I found myself embroiled in fighting for civil rights for Black people in our county and our city. That song, as we were doing that work, came flooding back to me. My grandmother knew all too well that those who had systemic power had systemic resource. And that while on the outside it looked like a purely political fight, it was so much more. As I researched and learned of the impact of this particular disenfranchisement of the Black vote, it was a battle that would decide resources to provide safety, investment, food, services, and leadership of choice for Black families and children who live in the Crescent, a place where I grew up as a child. And now being called on by the spirit of liberation to fight for other children growing up there, to address the legacy of injustices like redlining, divestment, racial block clubs, racial housing covenants and financial practices, and the pushing of Black families who came up from the South into two wards to live, the Third Ward and the Seventh Ward, making them question whether and where they belonged. These Black voters in this Crescent area were then politically incarcerated into voting districts that required that they only vote in coalition through majority-minority districts with other minorities, if any of them wanted to choose a candidate of their choice to represent them, while white voters did not. Their place in proportionate voting rights was limited to what they could figure out together, benefiting ultimately the white power structure. White voters had the freedom to choose their candidates without forced coalition voting, but not minorities. We called on this legislature to follow the census data, the Voting Rights Act, and to free the black vote. So I am happy to report that on Friday, we successfully got the legislature to enfranchise black voters in this county and city by a vote of 17 to 12. They freed the black vote. Black voters will now have proportionate voting power. You see, the thing about injustice is that it always makes you question where you belong. Injustice is about place setting and place making. In the first reading in the book of Sirach, which is a collection of wisdom proverbs and poetry that was often used as a handbook to consult in preparation for life lessons, we hear that the Lord is a God of justice. This 35th chapter focuses on the justice of God for the poor and the oppressed who have been wronged. It makes it clear that God cannot be bribed or dishonestly engaged with altar sacrifices, but that God lends God's ear to the prayers of those who have been wronged, the prayers of the oppressed. And in Sirach, it names two specific groups who live with wrong all the time: orphan children and widows, who seem to be put in positions to constantly pour out their complaints. This week, I had my first pastor's meeting with the Children's Defense Fund cohort. We began our meeting by being asked to reflect on a sermon preached by Dr. Starsky Wilson. And it was entitled, When Children Lead. And it was taken from Isaiah 11, about the lion laying down with the lamb. And it concludes with the reality that a little child would lead them. It was a first step for us developing a theology of thriving and wellness for children. But first, we had to reflect on how we saw them. Dr. Starsky acknowledged that this passage traditionally is often preached and reflected on in a messianic way about the Christ child. But he called our attention to reflect on its entirety as a vision for what happens when we actually let children lead us. He told a story about Dr. King, who received a letter from a classroom. A principal wrote a letter on behalf of her classroom in Albion, Michigan. Dr. King decided to respond to the class's letter with his own letter addressing the students of that school, who prompted their principal to contact him. And oddly enough, this letter didn't make it in any of the volumes of Dr. King's other letters because it was written to children. But he communicated to these children on December 1st, 1960. And here's an excerpt from that letter. He wrote, "There are also wonderful things happening in America and throughout the world that have to do with men's minds and the way that they think. Throughout Africa and Asia, men, women, and children are becoming free through the efforts of their leaders to make nations out of what was formerly protectants of big powers. Now these people have governments of their own, and this is freedom for them. Here in America, we have seen the American Negro and the American white man join hands to create freedom for the Negro. There are many men and women to help make this possible," he wrote. "Lawyers and doctors and ministers and bookkeepers and clerks and many who have special skills they have gained by studying and learning. It is through the effects of people like this that some full citizenship for all Americans will be a reality. There's great need," Dr. King wrote, "for some of you to help, to win this fight, to make our great nation exactly what we want it to be. I need the help of all of you. You must have some ability by which your efforts can be made useful. In this way, you too can help in the great struggle for human dignity. I know that you will not fail in your responsibilities as citizens and leaders of tomorrow. The whole country looks to you to help the nation reach the goals we want to reach. Good luck and God bless. Very truly yours, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King was responding here to the voices of the most marginalized in his community and in our world, children, investing in a call from those who required an audience with him without status. They had no standing. They had no stuff to offer him. But he knew that if we really, truly expected children to be our future, that we needed to see them differently right now. We needed to see them as full human beings right now. This weekend is a call for Children's Sabbath, a time where faith communities all over the world are being asked to pray and advocate for children and youth. Dr. King does more, though, than pray and advocate for them. He reminds them that they belong. They have a place in this world to help our country reach its goals of leading us in the struggles for human dignity. Dr. Starsky asked us after we listened, what did we hear in that sermon? We were asked to wrestle with what has gotten in our way of trusting children to lead us. Where are our blind spots that keep us from developing a theology of thriving for children and youth? He asked, is it our socialization of protection over preparation? Is it that we place a higher priority on those who come behind us instead of creating room for those already here to come alongside of us? Do we live in a society that forgets that children have the same capacity for brilliance and vision and wisdom as adults? The question was posed, are we culturally conditioned to not trust children to lead us? Are we stuck believing that we are to do all the leading, all the pouring into, all the guiding? And what if, when Isaiah says that a little child will lead them, he's actually talking about children who've been given to us by God to lead us in the right direction. But in order to do that, we must see them differently. And I had that lesson with my grandson, Jordan. He runs our camera every Sunday. He's around here somewhere. But when he was 7, we were driving a car and all of a sudden, this car came in the lane and cut me off, you know, and I got so mad, I started railing, you know, what is wrong with him? He could have hit us, and, you know, and I was getting ready to find my next syllable. I knew he couldn't hear me, but it didn't matter. But Jordan jumped right in, and he said, Nanny, we should be thankful that he didn't hit us. Just take a deep breath, Nanny. It's going to be okay. No wiser words, right, could have been spoken to me. He was leading me toward human dignity. This November, we have a parish visioning day. And as we were planning it, we realized that we've never had our children be part of shaping our vision. And so this time, we have a youth caucus. Teens will come alongside of us to dream with us, to direct our future, asking with us, where is God calling us to? We are communicating placemaking and place setting for our children because we know that belonging is connected to freedom. Freedom to vote, freedom to exist in the world in all spaces and all opportunities. And that is why in the gospel, Jesus addresses a parable with a story about belonging and placemaking. Two people go to a wall of power, a wall where God's presence is, a place where we go to lay our burdens down, a place to be seen, to be forgiven, to be healed when the weights we carry are too much, to find rest. One person allows their sense of self-righteousness and despisement to skew who belongs there. They began with a prayer that centers themselves in judgment of the other, leaving little room for God's voice. This person has already decided that for them, coming to God is simply an exercise in affirmation of how good he is. Now, we should all understand how good we are, right? Because that's not the problem. We are all good. But he goes a little bit further and decides how much better he is than the other. He's given himself a place of belonging while taking it away from the tax collector. The Pharisee thanks God that he's not like the rest of humanity, and especially this guy. Question is, do we thank God for not being like some other group or some other people? And if we do, is it time for us to be challenged to change our kind of prayer? Because all people are worth being. Sometimes people will say to me, "I am so glad I don't live in the city." Or, "Myra, how can you live in the city?" And there's just a bit of despisement on that. The truth is that I love living in the city. I love the people. I love their energy. I love their resilience. I love their cohesion. I love the way we take care of each other. I can pull over at any time and ask a stranger to help, and they will help me without hesitation. We always see each other's humanity. You see, we can choose how we see one another. We can choose the place that we make for each other in the world. This Pharisee placed himself as more righteous than the tax collector, more valuable to God because he participated in religious ritual and paid tithes. He saw his actions as legitimate bribes for God's favor. He chose not to see the humanity in the tax collector. This poor tax collector, who centered God and not himself, barely lifted up his eyes, beat his chest, and simply asked for mercy as a sinner. He knew that he needed God. He wasn't there to compare himself to anyone else. He needed God, as we all do, to affirm our place, our sense of belonging. As a tax collector, he had made many mistakes in his life. He knew what it was like to have people not see his humanity because of the work that he did. He was coming to grips with his mistakes. And he found that God knew that that did not mean that he didn't belong. The Pharisee represented the church, religion. And the church is supposed to be a place for those who are struggling, those who are oppressed, not a place to despise them. In fact, Jesus says that the tax collector went home more justified than the former. For whoever exalts oneself will be humbled, and whoever humbles oneself will be exalted. And we know that to be true. We know it's important how we see one another. Think about when we set the table and set place settings out for the guests who come to our homes. Right? We don't give this guest a small place setting, and then, you know, I'm going to give you a medium place setting, and then I'm going to give you a larger place setting, because I like you. They all get the same place setting. Just as when we come to this table of communion, we all get the same size host. God makes an equal place for all of us at this table. So today, Jesus calls on us to do the same. To be placemakers, place setters for the most vulnerable in our world, those who need us and God the most, to know that we have the power to see each other through different eyes and to create a place for them. The Pharisee in this gospel missed a wonderful opportunity to connect with the tax collector, to see him, to come alongside of him as two people who needed the power of God in their lives. He missed this opportunity to create belonging, to see the tax collector's humanity. And so Jesus invites us into that work today, friends, with those who are vulnerable and oppressed in our world, whether it be Black voters, children, or people like this poor tax collector dealing with social oppression. So Jesus challenges us to decide, what will we do in our world to create spaces of belonging, to engage in placemaking, so that we don't miss our opportunities like the Pharisee to be led in humility, decentering, and grace.